I have a few notes about different points that I wanted to make in lectures, so I'll go ahead and do that. Some points about independent thinking. I gave a lecture on this once in Salem, I believe, on independent thinking. Because Srila Prabhupada wrote in one of Srila Prabhupada's most famous letters, he mentioned this, in which he stated that he didn't want centralization of ISKCON. He said that each temple president, they should make their own decisions, and not that there should be very centralized management. Prabhupada said, even if they make mistakes, they can learn. This was Prabhupada's, I suppose, with that popular term, personality development. That was Srila Prabhupada's personality development formula, that give people some room to work in. So I discussed this previously in one lecture at some length a few years ago. But a few more points about that. Now, actually, this term of independent thinking, Srila Prabhupada, he made that in a letter which he was actually discussing about management within our society. Of course, so that people, they should take up responsibility, learn how to do different things. Srila Prabhupada, he wrote about registering the society in different places. Outside of India, our society, well, especially in America, our society, ISKCON is really a confederation of societies. It's not like here in India, we have one office registered in Bombay, but it's registered in all, is ISKCON of San Diego, which is legally a completely different entity from ISKCON of Los Angeles, I suppose. So Srila Prabhupada wanted that devotees learn to do all these things. I believe it was Kundali Prabhu in one of his books who extended this concept to the idea of being philosophically independently thinking. Of which, of course, there have to be limits to that. The whole idea is that we are to be guided by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. If we're absolutely independently thinking, which is actually not possible, but rather we are dependent. That's the point, that we come to Guru, Sadhu and Shastra understanding ourselves to be dependent. We cannot independently know anything. Even to discuss and use language, we have to learn language from others. So we're to have even any thought processes above that of the at the animal level, we have to be dependent on others. And actually, animals are also independent. Sorry, dependent. They're also dependent. Even the lions, they among themselves, they cooperate among themselves. Some animals maybe a python is very independent, but that's not a very advanced species. There's no intellectual life of a python. Monty Python, maybe. So we should be guided by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, but also there is room for independent thoughtfulness, because if there's not, you can't really understand anything. If one simply crams information, that's not really the same as philosophical understanding or realization. Actually, this term independent thinking just underlines the nature of independence in thinking, because if there is no thinking actually without independence. If you simply just follow what anyone says, that's not thinking. So thinking means that there's thinking. When I say thinking, I mean taking information, evaluating it, making judgments, and on the basis of that, implementing that information. And maybe offering different perspectives than those which others have offered before. That's the history of development in science, is that people offer different perspectives. And usually those that do are, usually scientists who offer a different perspective, they are ridiculed. Practically all of them. All the famous names in science. Well, Darwin wasn't. Galileo was. Many of them, they were ridiculed, but what are you talking about? For instance, at one time in the world, nobody believed in scientists didn't believe in meteorites. They said that stones can't fall out of space because there are no stones in space. And that was the scientific proof. And various museums that had meteorites threw them all out. Because they said some villagers, they say these things. It's just superstition. So that's changed now. Because some people dared to think differently. Srila Prabhupada was independently thoughtful inasmuch as he dared to think differently about bringing Krishna consciousness to the West. Anyone could have done it. Any one of his god brothers could have done it. And in fact, that Srila Prabhupada used that example, anyone could have done it. Or he replied to that. When he came back from the West, tremendously successful. I mean, even though Srila Prabhupada came back in 1971 with about 12 or 15 Western disciples, which nowadays we wouldn't think that was very much, but that became widely noted wherever he went, and Srila Prabhupada traveled widely and thousands of people would come to see. It was considered a major success because no one had dreamed that this was even possible. Sadhu, every sadhu means an Indian. Right? There's no sadhu is not a white man. White man is a saheb, not a sadhu. There's no question of a white man becoming a sadhu. Although there had been in India a few white men who had become sadhus, actually. There was Richard Nixon, I believe his name was, not the obviously not the president of America, but another Richard Nixon, an Englishman. He became initiated as a Vaishnava, and his ashram is still there in Almora. That's UP, is it? Or Himachal? It's somewhere up in the hills, Himalayan foothills. So his ashram is still there. He was an airline pilot in World War I, and he crashed. He was shot down in enemy territory, that means in German occupied territory. And as he was plunging toward the ground, he prayed to God, if you save me, I'll dedicate my life to you. And he woke up in a hospital on his side of the, somehow or other. And then after the war, he went to India because he thought, well, if you want to find God, you got a better chance over there. And then he was initiated by Bengali woman, who was the wife of the vice chancellor of Lucknow University. He was a Vaishnava. So, but anyway, it generally wasn't considered very possible that Westerners would become Vaishnavas. So Srila Prabhupada brought so many Westerners, actually in the beginning just a few, but it created a sensation. And some of, or if not most of Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers, who we might have expected would be very pleased about this, actually reacted very negatively. And they said, as did not all Indians welcomed, or Prabhupada. So many said that Westerners can't become sadhus. It's something like saying that stones can't fall from the sky because there are no stones in the sky. So if you see stones falling out of the sky and you report it, and the scientific answer will be, well, that's not possible because it goes against science. That's what usually happens when someone makes a discovery. I'm just reading a book by Richard Milton called Forbidden Science, and he read that? Heard of it. And it notes so many, like a history of all the bungles in science, or the major bungles. Interestingly, he mentions the Krishna consciousness movement in that book and says that he listed, among others, which in the 1970s, that was the Krishna consciousness movement was something new and very strange in the West. But he lists it among others who said, well, I can't remember exactly the comment he made, but the point was that you shouldn't reject a priori any statements they make because their perspective is different. Their perspective on the nature of reality is different. There may be perspectives on reality which are not incorrect just because we think they should be. So what was the point I was speaking about before I branched off? Richard Milton, Forbidden Science. Yeah, I know that's the main topic. Anyway, Prabhupada, Prabhupada's God brothers and many others, yeah, they said that, well, they can't be sadhus because Westerners can't be sadhus. So, just like, for instance, if you see a white bird, medium-sized bird, that waddles on the land and swims nicely and quacks, what do you call it? A duck, right? It's got all the symptoms of a duck, therefore it's a duck. So if someone completely acts like a sadhu, then you call them a sadhu. But if you say, well, it can't be a sadhu because sadhus only come from India, well, shows that they're a sadhu. It's not stated in Shastra that one has to be born in India to be a sadhu. So there are many people, including mostly from the Brahmana caste and from among Prabhupada's God brothers, who said that these cannot be sadhus. You cannot be a Hindu. You have to be born a Hindu. I used to hear this in the 1970s in India. That in your next life, if you can be born as a Hindu, but now you cannot be a Hindu. We used to hear this all the time. So I used to say, well, thank you very much. I don't want to be a Hindu. I want to be a devotee of Krishna. So anyway, Prabhupada was much maligned and by certain people, and many of them would go out of the way to find faults in Srila Prabhupada's disciples just to prove that they're not sadhus. But then others begrudgingly accepted that Srila Prabhupada had done something wonderful. And then some of them would say, well, you know, but okay, but anyone could do that. Anyone could have gone to the West and preached and made devotees. Anyone could have done that. So Srila Prabhupada told the story of Christopher Columbus, who is supposed to have discovered America. Although there are plenty of people living in America before that, but according to the Western way of thinking, if we didn't know about it, it didn't exist. So when he came back and was praised, then so many others said, well, anyone could have done that. So in the court of the king and queen of Portugal, I believe it was, he assembled all his detractors and he brought a chicken's egg and said, stand it up vertically. Let's see if any of you can stand this up vertically on a table. And you could imagine what happened. Is it possible to balance a chicken's egg, or any egg for that matter, vertically on a table? You can just place it there and try and keep it, but definitely it's going to fall over, right? So Christopher Columbus, when they'd all tried and failed, Christopher Columbus came along and took it up with the shorter end of the ellipsoid, I believe it's called. No, an ellipsoid would be a two-dimensional figure. Anyway, the big end at the bottom. Let's make it easy. And just slightly cracked it, and then stood it up. That's how you stand an egg vertically on a table. And they said, well, anyone could have done that. It's easy afterwards to say so. So Srila Prabhupada was independently thoughtful in his manner of, first of all, that he even thought about preaching Krishna consciousness in the West. And that he not only thought about it, but he actually went and did it, and did whatever was necessary to make it successful. When he first arrived in America, for the first few months, a lot of the time, it seems he wasn't doing that much preaching. He was just studying the culture. And then he tried to interest people of what you might call the intellectual class, elite class, but he didn't get much interest. He didn't elicit much serious interest. And then somehow or other he ended up among the hippies. Maybe a combination of circumstances, one of them being his poverty. I mean, richness of soul, no doubt, but poverty. He didn't have any money, so he had to go to the poorest place, which is where, among others, the hippies used to live. And another reason might be that he'd seen the uptown swamis, as they were called. There were other. Srila Prabhupada was by no means the first Indian swami to go to the West. There were several in New York City, already before Prabhupada got there. But they mostly, at that time, they moved among the middle class, somewhat elderly middle class people who were superficially interested in Eastern mysticism. Srila Prabhupada, he became quite close with one such Swami, Dr. Mishra, who had come to America as a medical doctor, but started teaching yoga for whatever reason. He started teaching yoga, and Dr. Mishra had a mix of this. We get the impression of somewhat elderly, middle-class people and some younger people maybe interested in yoga. So Srila Prabhupada saw that some of the younger people, they have interest in that. So that may be one reason also that he gravitated to the hippies. Anyway, Srila Prabhupada, he found the ways and means to communicate with the hippies and instill Krishna consciousness in them, which was not possible to do by any of the means of preaching Krishna consciousness that he was used to. Of course, the basic activities were there. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, and Prasadam. But the formalities, the respect that was accorded to Swamis, none of that was there in the West. Preaching Krishna consciousness in India could at that time, and now also, be done in a fairly stereotyped kind of way. You just go and you give a lecture and people say, thank you very much, Swamiji, and they're very polite. And then if you make a good enough show, then some people might want to be your disciples. And if you're busy and you work hard, you can gradually have some effect in preaching. But in the West, especially in those days, there was no such culture like that. There were gurus, but no one had any idea of really what it meant to have a guru or to surrender to a guru or the commitment required for spiritual life. It's just so completely different. So Srila Prabhupada found the ways and means to communicate his message, to get through to people. And when I say found the ways and means, again, it's not like a kind of clinical formula. But Srila Prabhupada was one of the main reasons Srila Prabhupada was highly successful was because he was highly personable. He interacted with people and he really cared for them and he gave them himself to people. So, I'm just using that as an example of how Srila Prabhupada was independently thoughtful, but at the same time, very traditional. What did he bring, Krishna consciousness? He never compromised on any of the principles, and any of the basic principles. And very early on, several of his earliest disciples have noted that very early on, they realized that Srila Prabhupada was never going to compromise the philosophy. Recently a book came out by His Holiness Mukunda Goswami, who was one of Srila Prabhupada's very first disciples. It's called Miracle on Second Avenue, and it's a very candid recollection of one devotee's own experiences and interaction with Srila Prabhupada. It's so candid, it's almost shocking. Because, he was a young hippie type. Not exactly a hippie, but something like that. And he speaks candidly about his relationships with his girlfriend, who Prabhupada married actually. The first marriage was with Mukunda and Janaki. And his attitude towards Swami, it wasn't that he was immediately very reverential. And I questioned one of those earliest devotees recently in Mayapur at the festival. I met Umapati Swami, who told me that all the early devotees, they thought that Prabhupada was just too much. They thought he was just too heavy, and they thought that his attitude of being confident that he was completely correct, they thought that was off. How can you be so sure of yourself and so correct? So they appreciated him in many ways, but they were, at that time, basically young Americans, Western. They were hippies. They weren't surrendered. It wasn't that they even had any idea of being surrendered. They had no idea of what it means to surrender to a guru or to surrender to anything. So Mukunda Goswami wrote in that book that there was some point, I can't remember what it was, maybe it was about illicit sex, and it was that Prabhupada, he just wouldn't compromise. He wouldn't change the message. Even though hippie life was, two of the major features of hippie life were intoxication and illicit sex. And mixed up with that was the some kind of something resembling a search for enlightenment, spiritual enlightenment. So Prabhupada wouldn't compromise on that. And Umapati told me that Prabhupada was so, because they were all reading books by all different impersonalists, and Prabhupada was just, one day he just completely blasted them. He got extremely angry. They didn't really consider themselves his followers. They would come to listen to him, and they liked him, and they'd help him, but they didn't consider themselves disciples. They had their own way of thinking also. It wasn't that they thought of Prabhupada as their guru. And Prabhupada, one day, he got extremely angry and blasted them. It was over this Dr. Radhakrishnan's Bhagavad Gita commentary, where Dr. Radhakrishnan says, not unto Krishna, but the unborn within Krishna that we have to surrender. When he came to this, he said, you see, I told you he was a rascal. Just see what a rascal he is for saying this. And then Keith, who was later initiated as Kirtanananda, he started defending and saying, well, actually, it's not so bad. You know, Shankara says this, and so-and-so from China says this, and St. John of the Cross says that. Prabhupada was just sitting there, looking angry. And then he asked Keith paused, and then he said, have you finished? And Keith went on some more, and he long talking about how actually impersonalism is correct. And then again Prabhupada said, have you finished? And Keith said yes, and then Prabhupada just smashed the table. He was furious, and said that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's nothing unborn within Krishna. It is to Krishna that we have to surrender. Why do you deny Krishna? That was Prabhupada's point. He was extremely angry. Now at that point, all of these people, they were the only one people who had come to him after over a year in America. But Prabhupada, he wouldn't, just for the sake of keeping them, compromised with their impersonalism. They could, quite possibly, they could have just all walked out the door and never come back. But Prabhupada wasn't going to compromise with them, just to keep them. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said the same thing. He said, even if the whole world is against me, and even if all my disciples leave me, I'm not going to stop speaking the truth. So that's independent thinking. The subject is independent thinking. That totally dependent on Krishna and not dependent on anyone or anything within this world. That is independence. Fully independent we cannot be. Only Krishna is fully independent. But a devotee is fully dependent on Krishna and he doesn't depend on anyone or anything. He doesn't want anything or anyone. We can see from that incident that I just mentioned of Srila Prabhupada that he had nothing to get from anyone. He wasn't anxious to make disciples just for the sake of having disciples. For showing, you see, now I have some Western disciples, or now I have so many disciples. But he wanted to serve Krishna and give Krishna to others. And that is not possible simply by some cheap show of guruship or cheap show of discipleship. There has to be surrender. There has to be a complete rejection of anything but the actual truth. Therefore, dharma, projhita, kaitava, atra, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, all cheating religion is rejected. So, yeah, real independent thinking is that complete dependence on Krishna. That sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Independence means complete dependence. How is it possible? Independence means to be totally independent. But no, that is the minute independence that the jiva has, to choose to place his dependence on Krishna, who is Sharanyam, who is worth taking shelter of. Bhavambati vatsa padang parang padang. What, no, what's that verse? Samashrita ye padda pallava plavang mahatpadang punya yashomara. No, but there's another verse, Sharanya. That's devarshi bhutapta nirang pitrinam na kinkaro nayam renichara jansaratmanaya sharanam sharanyam gato mukundam parihrityakaratam. That not being dependent on devas, demigods, bhuta here means other living beings, not ghosts, relatives, on human beings, rishis, animals, whatever. Without being dependent on any of them, if one takes full shelter of Krishna, that is Krishna consciousness. So that is the minute independent thinking, that one is not carried away by the way of thinking of this world, but sees everything in relationship to Krishna. Traditionally in India, the pundits, they were vastly learned. Srila Prabhupada writes in the first canto that no one should dare to sit on the Vyasasana unless he could master all the six philosophies, the difference. And that was the standard for a Vaishnava Acharya. Rasikananda, you may know of his life, of his appearance in this world. He staged wonderful festivals with dramas and with Sankirtan, and so many people became his disciples. But in his youth, in his childhood, he was trained in all philosophy. It wasn't that he was only doing singing and dancing and festivals, but he debated with so many people. He knew all the philosophies and how to defeat them all and establish Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings as topmost. So one has to be thoughtful to do that. In debate was part of the tradition of Indian intellectual culture. Debate was a major feature. We find that the various acharyas, they established themselves and their teachings by traveling and debating. Shankaracharya traveled all over India and debated with brahmanas and made them his disciples, made them sannyasis. Ramanuja also. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also had stated that while he was traveling in South India, he met so many the followers of different schools. The different schools are mentioned as Sri Vaishnava, Tattvavadi, Jain, Buddhist, Sankhya, so many different schools. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would speak with them and convince them of the superiority of his own teachings. So in debate, you can never be quite sure what someone's going to say. So you have to be sharp-witted. That means that you can't just learn the philosophy in a book style to write some answers in a test, but you have to be able to deeply understand it so as to be able to present it in a manner that defeats others, and defeat others not for the sake of defeating others, but to bring them to the actual correct point. That's why Vaishnavas are not particularly interested in debate in the Gaudiya Vaishnavas are not particularly interested in debate in the traditional manner, because the traditional manner means you become a Digvijay, you become famous as the best debater, and all the honor goes to you. But Gaudiya Vaishnavas, they're not interested in showing themselves to be very big, but they simply want to disabuse people of their incorrect understanding and bring them to the right point for their own benefit of surrendering to Krishna. And actually at Galta near Jaipur, when Baladev Vidyabhushan, he debated with Ramanujiya Vaishnavas, and much to the surprise of those Vaishnavas, Baladev was able to establish the Gaudiya Vaishnava Siddhanta and the Shastric basis of the worship of Radha. So when he defeated them in debate, they did the honorable thing, which everyone's supposed to do. If you're defeated in debate, you're supposed to become the follower of that person. But he said, no, that's all right. You stay in your sampradaya. It's not that he wanted to say, I'm right, therefore you're all wrong. He's saying that Ramanuja line, that's, he accepted, yes, that's also bona fide line of Vaishnavism. So he said, you remain in your own line. So, this independent thinking, one can actually independently, or one can think properly if one has been trained. Otherwise, thinking can be very dangerous. If one, in the name of thinking, is guided by sensual desire, if one's aim in life is to enjoy the senses, then thinking becomes very dangerous. And modern philosophies, they spring out of the lower modes of nature. Actual philosophy should come from the search for truth. Atato Brahma Jignasa. And following this desire to come to the highest point of understanding, or understanding what is actual reality, then one should take guidance and try to understand what is that reality. But without that, if one is simply interested in sense gratification and you try to philosophize, then you come up with many, many problems. Hitler was also a philosopher. The most famous demon of the 20th century, although others like Churchill were probably at least as bad, but Churchill's side won, so he got the good press, whereas Hitler's side lost, so he got represented as all bad. So he was also a philosopher. His whole movement was based on his philosophy. He wrote a book, which is famous even today, although it's difficult to get a copy of because it's considered so dangerous. Mein Kampf, which means my something or other. I don't know German. So anyway, he puts forward his philosophy there, is that we are Germans, and we're better people. We're Aryan. Somehow that word Aryan got misappropriated. And everyone else, they're just a bunch of lesser people. So we need more space for our people, therefore we're going to kick all these neighboring people out of their countries and take them over. And as far as the Jews are concerned, they're just a nuisance, so better get rid of all of them. And it was a philosophy of sorts. And it was on the basis of that that people became his followers, and he became very powerful. So it's also a philosophy, but it's demoniac. He was thinking. He was definitely thinking. No one else had come up with such ideas in that particular lucid form that he did. So he was thinking, but it was very dangerous. Shayaya jagat ahita. Ahitaha, the demons. They come up with ideas that are very inauspicious for the world. Yesterday I saw in the newspaper, I usually look at the headlines, so one of them is that 36, I think, more ideal villages are going to be made in Maharashtra. So I looked at the report. So what are the ideal villages? It's all based on cash crops, is one thing. Another thing is that one of the conditions in an ideal village is that there is compulsory, how do you pronounce that? Vasectomy? Vasectomy, which means operating, cutting and tying up in a knot the pipes, the ducts, so that the semen can't come out. In other words, sterilization. So that's one of the... If you want to be in an ideal village, it's forcible sterilization. So I thought it might be a good idea, ideal village, but demoniac, actually demoniac. So someone's thinking that, see, we have a problem with, they're doing this in Vidarbha, in Maharashtra, which is a very extremely arid area. They only get, how much? 400 millimeters a year or something. Very much less rainfall than the national average. So it's very difficult for farmers. So now they're doing some good things like rainwater harvesting, but they mix it up with so many wrong ideas that it's far from ideal. But they're thinking. They thought of something different and new to benefit the people. But because they don't know what actual benefit for the people is, then they come up with all sinful ideas. So, in many ways it's better than not everyone thinks. Only if you don't know what or how to think or what the purpose of life is, better be guided by people who know. Now in India, so I'm told, they started something which has been a fashion in the democratic West for many years, that a TV interviewer will just stop someone in the street, or they call people into the studio and they ask you, well, what do you think about this, 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 this and this? And someone says, well, I think, and someone else says, well, I think. As if everyone is supposed to have an opinion on everything. People don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what the real issues are. Now elections, people are voting. What are they voting for? What do they know about all the complexities of modern economics and politics? But everyone gets a vote. Foolishness. What actually happens is that the idea sounds very good. Everyone should have an equal vote. But what actually happens is that it's those who are more intelligent exploit others. That's all. Giving equal rights is not good unless people... Therefore they say, well, everyone should have equal education. But then the education is also manipulating people to make them think in a certain way. And in fact, the modern education is so tricky that people actually train you to think that you're thinking for yourself. But you're not at all. it's like if you make a little corral, That means a little compound this size. And you tell anyone, you're free to go wherever you like within this like house arrest. You can go wherever you like, you see, you can go. But there's no way you can get out. So that's the freedom you have. You're caught in a mental or intellectual trap where you can't think beyond the boundaries that are imposed on you by the education system, but you think that you're free. In Islam, thinking is not encouraged at all. Don't think, just follow, that's all. Just the imams, they will think, they will fight among themselves. They don't tell others that they're fighting among themselves. Like the scientists don't tell others. They make this, yes, scientists say, as if they all think the same thing. But they're all arguing with each other like cats and dogs. But they present as if they all think the same thing. So previously in Christianity also, the idea that to think for yourself was considered very bad. You just follow the priests, that's all. And then when the printing press came out and they started printing Bibles so people could read the Bibles for themselves, then people who were printing Bibles and distributing them to others, the church executed them. They burned them alive. Because they think people should not see the Bible. We will tell them what's in the Bible. They shouldn't see the Bible. And so nowadays if you distribute Bibles, Christians think that's very good. But when they first started doing it, they executed them for the crime against God of giving people knowledge of what's in the books. So that was the system in India also, that people would learn from the Brahmanas. Of course the Brahmin classes, as it was, is largely corrupt now. And even though we do find some, just like here in Guruvayur, who perform all the rituals, but they don't know what the proper understanding is. So Srila Prabhupada, he wanted to create a new class of brahmanas. New class means, again, the basic principle is, what is a sadhu? Is a sadhu someone from India who has a long beard and some reddish cloth? Maybe you could say that, but really the symptom of a sadhu is someone who is pursuing spiritual life very seriously, following all the principles, studying the Shastra, living according to the Shastra. That's a better definition of a sadhu than someone from India with a beard and red cloth. So in the same way, who is a brahmana? Someone born in a brahmana family, maybe. But a better definition is someone who's actually cultivating spiritual life very seriously. So that we find there are still brahmanas today born in brahmana families. There are still some who follow the brahmana way of life, but they can't give guidance to others practically on how to live a spiritual life because they're not thinking. They're not thinking how to benefit others. No such thought in their mind even of how to benefit others by giving them knowledge of the ultimate reality. They don't think about such things. You'll find everywhere people, the brahmanas, they worship in the temple, then they go home and watch the TV like anyone else. It's just a job. Someone has a job as a college lecturer, someone has a job as a butcher, someone has a job as an auto driver, and someone has a job as a priest, that's all. And they all do the same thing when they go home, they all just turn on the TV. That's all. And they don't think there's even, they don't find any incongruency with that. They think, well, alright, finished my puja and now came home, watched the TV. I don't find anything incongruous with that. So actual Brahmana who can be a spiritual leader should be very well versed in Shastra, and especially in Prabhupada's books, because Prabhupada's books, they are not only the essence of Shastra, but they are presented in a way to give practical direction to human society. So, these are the kind of independently thinking brahmanas who can apply the teachings of Shastra and present them in varying circumstances for the guidance of others who are actually fit to lead human society on the basis of Shastric knowledge. Okay, I'll finish there unless there are any questions. I guess Gokul Chandra is in charge of organizing this. It's more or less fallen on him. Krishnadas is here also. Krishnadas is you do all the practical things, right? So, what I suggest during class, you have someone on the gate stopping any vehicles coming inside. Because all the time, if they're coming, it's a disturbance. They can stop outside and like that. Okay? The next class will be this evening, and plenty of people will be coming at that time, so you can stop them from coming inside. Okay? Any questions about this? Yes, please. Intelligence should be guided by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra. Oh, actually, as you brought that up, that's a very important point, which I should have made, which I'll make now. I don't know what you're going to ask, but what I'm saying is that, yeah, I said it, but I didn't really make it very clear, is that we should always be guided by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, but the very nature of life in this world is so complex that you can't find a textbook solution to every problem in every situation. What to do in each situation, you might not find it in Shastra. There are many, the Shastras are very wide and they give many instances of all kinds of unusual things, like for instance in one instance Krishna told Arjuna to seriously insult Yudhishthira. He told Arjuna to do that. So, and then telling Arjuna to kill Karna when Karna was in a situation where he should not, according to the laws of battle, be killed. So there are all kinds of unusual things in Shastra, because this, which just goes to show that this world, it's highly variegated, and we need to have an understanding of the principles of Shastra and how to apply them, but you won't find a textbook solution to every problem. I guess it's like that in medicine also, right? If someone has tonsillitis, what they used to do is cut out the tonsils. They still do that? According to certain criteria. But if you have, say, four different diseases at once, complicated by just being in a road accident, then exactly how to treat, I don't think there'd be any. Say you have cholera, typhoid, malaria and jaundice all at the same time, which is possible. And you're being brought to the hospital and you get in an accident also. And you're still trying to keep the person alive, which is also possible, if they're not too seriously injured. Then exactly how to treat, what to do first, you're not going to find anything in a textbook about that. So by experience and maybe in consultation with other doctors, with a prayer to God, you decide what's the best thing to do. So it's like that. Life is very complex. So how exactly to apply all the how to apply the teachings of Shastra in various circumstances. Shastra gives general directions. The guru teaches us, but he may not be there all the time. And even if he is there, he might say, well, you decide. You use your intelligence. So, what was your question? If you're guided by Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, is it really independent thinking? Well, I already answered that, didn't I? That when we say independent, we don't mean totally independent. Independent means that we choose where to place our dependence. But independent is there, has to be there. Just like this case of dealing with a complex emergency for a doctor to do so. He just can't consult books. He has to make some decision based on the principles that he knows. So, one will always find oneself in that situation. A similar kind of situation. There are many such instances. There's the story of the two sadhus were walking and they came to a river which was fordable. That means you can walk through it. But nowadays there's no boat and no bridge. But some woman said, look, I want to cross this river, but the current is too strong for me. Can you help me across? And one of the sadhus picked her up, put her on his shoulders and walked over the river. And then put her down and walked on. And then they walked on in silence. And after about half an hour, one sadhu said to the other, you carried a woman. And when sadhu said, yeah, I carried her for 3 minutes over the river, but you've been carrying her in your mind ever since. So should you or shouldn't you? In that circumstance, what should you do? What should a sadhu do? Should you help her to get across the river or just leave her? So life is like that, more complex than can be given guidelines for in each circumstance. So one has to be thoughtful, actually. Independent thinking is required. Independent thinking means how to apply Shastra. And not only independent thinking is not only on application, but also understanding. How to understand Shastra. For instance, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam. He is Krishna, who is imbued with the feelings and bodily lustre of Radha, whose ecstasy is in separation from Krishna. So, Jiva Goswami apparently supports the Swakiyavad that Krishna is married with all the gopis. But later Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said, actually that's not the real philosophy. The real Gauriya philosophy is Parakiya, that the gopis relate to Krishna as if they are married and having, from the social point of view, an illicit relationship with Krishna. So that is Gauriya understanding. Although Jiva Goswami, who is considered by everyone, all Gauriyas, pretty much all Gauriyas, as the philosophical, what's the word? Arbitra? He's the lawmaker, or the one who has presented Gauriya understanding Jiva Goswami says the opposite. And Vishwanath contradicts that. Apparently contradicts it. And then later Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur says actually there's no contradiction. So it for philosophical points, it may require some independent and some new way of thinking or a different perspective to that which is considered normal. That may be required also. And that's required now also. I mean, just like we see, people have different understandings of Srila Prabhupada and his teachings. For instance, some people say that, well, because Srila Prabhupada gave so many concessions for preaching in the West, they should remain forever. And others say, well, Prabhupada gave certain concessions, but that doesn't mean that he wanted to overthrow the whole tradition. It's just that people in the West, they were so far away from that tradition that you had to make some concessions for them. So that is actually a major point of cultural divisiveness within our ISKCON. So what Srila Prabhupada did and what his intention was, because Srila Prabhupada apparently allowed some divorces, does that mean that divorce is just completely normal and allowed within ISKCON? These kind of questions come up. Anything else? Yeah. How do we distinguish between deviations and adjusting according to time, place and circumstance? Well, what one person calls a deviation, someone else will call an adjustment according to time, place and circumstance. One has to have a thorough grasp of the principles. When Srila Prabhupada was asked this question, exactly this question, he said, that requires some intelligence. Yeah. There are two different opinions, someone else reconciles and then says they're both correct. What is this? Thesis, antithesis and synthesis. And yeah, but then that the synthesis becomes the third opinion and someone refutes that. This is called Tarka Pantha. The path of argumentation. And as is famously stated, Tarka Apratishta. By this path one can never ultimately establish anything. It goes on and on and on. Therefore one should know what is the Vastava Satya, the actual truth. In ISKCON, how are the Brahmanas being trained? Well, you're supposed to be a Brahmana, an ISKCON Brahmana. How are you trained? You write some exam, and that's it. You become a Brahmana. I'm not in favor of this. I mean, there's something is there, but I'd like to see a lot more training. In fact, some people are coming here to with a recommendation for Brahminical initiation, but I'm not going to give it to them. Because as I see it, that there should be a lot more training. And not just in philosophical understanding, but in behavior. I mean, when I say behavior, I don't mean just talking politely, but things like, for instance, not stepping over bhoga or prasadam. All these points one should know. One should actually have the symptoms of a Brahmana. In one letter, Srila Prabhupada indicated that people who are working in jobs, how can they be brahmanas? If they're not living as brahmanas, if they're not fully dedicated to serving Krishna, then why should they be called brahmanas? Everyone's, I have one disciple who's practically begging me for brahminical initiation, but why should, in one sense, a Vaishnava is more than a Brahmana. That's there. Then, if we want to establish Varnashram society for the benefit of human society, understanding that a Vaishnava's position is intrinsically above that of a worldly Brahmana, but then why make everyone a Brahmana? Then how are you going to establish Varnashram? So if you want brahminical initiation, don't get initiated by me unless you really want to be a brahmana. Mostly I see people want it for some kind of prestige. That's what I see within our society. That, you know, now I'm a brahmana. But what's that got to do with becoming Krishna conscious and going back to Godhead? Increasing one's prestige. So I'm inclined to give it to devotees who are actually engaged as brahmanas. Even if they're living in the ashram, maybe not. But they should be preachers, teachers, pujaris, cooks, like actually performing brahminical functions. Otherwise in temple communities, it's not that everyone's a brahmana. In fact, some of the functions in temple communities are only to be done, I'm talking about traditional temples, they're only to be done by Shudras, like carrying the torch in the procession, the deity procession, that's to be done by Shudra. Brahman is not allowed to do it. Washing the clothes of the deity, the particular caste has to do that, not Brahmanas. That's in traditional temples. So if we make everyone a brahmana, then who's going to wash the clothes of the deity? If we want to recreate Varnashram society. So, it's not just by... That's our complaint against so many people, brahmana caste. They just have a string on their shoulder. That's the only way you can tell they're a brahmana. And if they're not in Tamil Nadu by their name, of course in Tamil Nadu you have Iyengar, but in North India, there's any part of India, Sharma, Shukla, Dvivedi, Trivedi, Chaturvedi, Bandopadhyay, Mukhopadhyay, Vyas, all these names. So many Brahmana names, Pujari, Purohit, Goswami, Brahmachari. Some family name is Brahmachari. So these are all... It's like... It's, you know, people say, well, my father was a pure devotee. Or, well, my grandfather was a, you know, famous pundit. Well, my grandfather was a Naishtik Brahmachari. So it's not just by designation. One should actually be trained and have the qualities and perform the function. Just like you can be called a doctor just if you have the training, but if you don't perform the function, you're not really a doctor. Like Dr. Savyasachi, he's called Dr. Savyasachi, but he's not really a doctor because he doesn't practice. Yeah. Well, if you see a slum, Islam. There seems to be less division. Really? Less division compared to Hinduism? Yeah, but the division's bad enough, isn't it? I mean, look at Pakistan where Muslims are all, they're very much divided and killing each other. You may say, if people don't think, then there's less divisiveness. Yeah, it's called a herd mentality. If you make everyone like sheep, then they may be less divisive, but then sheep can't be trained in Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness is meant for humans, not for sheep. But most people don't actually, I mean, they may say that I'm thinking, but most people don't like to think, actually. Most people prefer just to follow. And many people join a religious group because they want their thinking done for them. They don't want to think at all. Just, okay, I've got my priest or I've got my guru and whatever he says, okay, finished. By the way, May the 21st is Judgment Day. You know that? I saw it on the internet, so it must be true. Jesus is coming again, and all you heathens will be thrown into hell to burn forever, because Jesus loves you. So just warning you. It's on the internet, must be true. It's just over a week from now. Actually, just 1 week from now is Judgment Day. Feeling nervous? You can go and convert immediately. And if you're a Brahmin, you can remain a Christian Brahmin. They don't intermarry with other Christians, only with Christian Brahmins. Of course, you don't have much time, because Judgment Day is coming in just 1 week. Independent thinking only restricted to tattva-darshi, or actually tattva-darshi automatically will be independently thinking. But there's tattva-vicharak also. There's tattva-gyata, tattva-vicharak. Can it be restricted? Well, you can't restrict it actually. But you can restrict education. That restricts thinking a lot. Modern education is a disaster in terms of this spiritual realization of the world, because it fills people's minds with all kinds of wrong ideas. It's not that people in Vedic culture are not educated. Everyone is educated. But it's not that everyone... See, in the modern age we think that education means you have to learn to read and write. But actually, reading and writing is for less intelligent people. Of course, intelligent people would also learn to read and write. There might be letters that you could write. But actually, intelligent people learn by hearing only. So, reading and writing is actually a concession, or that education is via the medium of written books is actually a concession for less intelligent people. Because actually, intelligent people learn just by hearing. But everyone would learn, not that everyone would learn to read and write, but everyone would regularly hear recitation of Ramayana, Puranas, and in this way they would learn. So it's not that people were uneducated, but maybe not educated in what we call the modern sense. But nowadays people are less educated than in my generation, thanks to computers. How many kids of 10 years old could, if you give them, tell them to multiply 1972 by 31,241, they can write down the figures and multiply them. They don't know how to do it. They're never trained because they have calculators. So modern education in many ways makes you more stupid. Yeah, Arjuna, Akrura was a pure devotee. Father-in-law? Shvafalka, what's his name? They were always arguing with each other. Well, even Krishna was arguing with his wife all the time, Satyabhama. That was Prem Kolaha, argument of love. Although it seemed that, well, in the case of Akrura and Kritavarma killing the father of Satyabhama, actually, Satyabhama. Prabhupada says, or the Prabhupada quotes the previous acharyas as saying that Akrura offended the residents of Vrindavan, especially the gopis, by taking Krishna away. And Kritavarma, well, that must have been after the... After the battle? Couldn't have been. But anyway, Kritavarma, he ended whatever. He happened to end up on the Kaurava's side in the battle. So he said, because they made some offense. Therefore they... I need a little independent philosophizing to understand all this. It's quite complex, isn't it? They're eternal associates of the Lord. But in the case of eternal associates of the Lord, even if it's seen that there's some offense, but it's always understood that that is impelled by Krishna's Leela Shakti to demonstrate some point, just like Arjuna was apparently bewildered so that the opportunity came for Krishna to speak Bhagavad Gita. So nowadays there's a lot of talk about human Prabhupada, and he had all these human... You know about that? You're lucky. But how are we to understand Prabhupada's mistakes and all this kind of... But that's not the way that we see that. We should understand that... Mang Partha Daiving Mahatma Nastu Mang Partha Daiving Prakriti Mahashritaha. Pure devotees are under the shelter of the Krishna's internal potency. It's not that sometimes they're Krishna conscious and sometimes they're not. They're always under the shelter of Krishna's internal potency. So we shouldn't think that they're materially conditioned souls. If we Jato Deko Vaishnava Bebahara Dugnis Choijaneho Taha Paranandashuk. If we see a Vaishnava who is apparently suffering in this material world, we should understand it's just another phase of his transcendental bliss. We should never see Vaishnavas as ordinary people. It's an offense to do so. I'm going to finish here because I have many things to do.